Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness. Brought to you by Forever Family Foundation. On the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name. The echo is haunting. The echo is always the same. I call your name. The echo is haunting. An echo can never be changed. So I call your name.
And welcome to Signs of Life. Thanks for joining us. Tonight we have a terrific guest, a friend of the foundation, Dr. Jeff Tarrant. Jeff is the founder and director of the Neuro Meditation Institute in Eugene, Oregon. He's a licensed psychologist and board certified in neurofeedback. Jeff is also the chief science officer of Helium. That's H-E-A-L-I-U-M, XR, creating biometrically controlled virtual and augmented reality experiences. Dr. Tarrant specializes in teaching, clinical applications, and research combining technology-based interventions with meditative states for improved mental health. His research focuses on exploring brainwave changes that occur as a result of contemplative practices, technological interventions, and non-ordinary states of consciousness and psi-related abilities. Jeff's the author of the books Meditation Interventions to Rewire the Brain and Becoming Psychic. In addition to his clinical background, Dr. Tarrant has also trained extensively in a variety of spiritual and meditative practices. And his clinical work includes ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, which is done in association with two separate physicians. He also offers a variety of technology-assisted interventions for nervous system balance. His websites are Dr. Jeff Tarrant, that's TARRANT.me, and NeuroMeditationInstitute.com. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, your introduction takes up most of the show. So.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, yeah, man, okay.
Yeah, I left out a ton of stuff, too. But a lot of stuff that we can talk about. In your book, Becoming Psychic, you talk about psychic mind science, and probably people look at that and say, well, what the hell is psychic mind science? Let's start there. What is psychic mind science? You know, what it is and how it might help us?
Yeah, so there's two answers to that question.
Okay.
So psychic mind science was actually kind of the spinoff company that I created when I started more seriously doing this work, because, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners will appreciate this, a lot of the more traditional people that I interact with kind of balked when I started talking about psychic abilities and mediumship and telekinesis. Yeah, and there was some pushback. I actually lost a contract from somebody that wasn't appreciating what I was doing. So I made the decision to kind of do a split off. And so psychic mind science became its own kind of brand. Really the reason I came up with that name is trying to find something very, tight that conveyed exactly what we're trying to do, which is look at psychic abilities, broadly speaking, and how that interacts or intersects with the mind and or the brain, because I don't necessarily see those as the exact same thing. And of course, trying to do this from a scientific perspective. So that's what we're about, right? Is trying to understand these things and then figure out how we can use our understanding to help other people who are exploring this work.
Yeah. You know, you just mentioned something interesting, saying that, the brain and mind may not necessarily, be the same thing, which we find is prevalent in the type of work that we do. And it's always been somewhat of an anomaly, because people in the that are into spiritual practice will always say that the key to succeeding and reaching these altered states of consciousness is getting your brain quiet or out of the way. And yet a good part of your research involves, studying different, brain regions, so which raises the question, does our brain play a role or a big role in these intuitive and psychic experiences that people have? So there's no easy answer to that, but you're going to give me one.
In 30 seconds,
Yeah.
let me answer that. It's interesting because the conclusion that I have come to, at least for now, right? Because again, from a science perspective, you can change your mind, right? If there's new data that comes in, then we change how we think about things. But at
Right.
least for now, the way that I understand some of these abilities and its relationship to the brain is that the brain is largely a filter. And this isn't really up for debate. We know this, that the brain, a large part of what the brain does is filters out information so that we're only focused on what is deemed biologically relevant in the moment. So what do you need to know? What do you need to pay attention to survive? And everything else, the brain usually is pretty good at getting that out of there. It just ignores it completely. Like you don't even perceive it. It doesn't mean it's not there. It's just the brain filters it out. And so I think what happens in a lot of instances with people who are quite skilled in psychic or mediumship type work is that they've figured out how to, sort of open that filter. So they've, they're essentially getting the brain out of the way. So the brain is actually limiting us, and they've figured out how to bypass it, at least temporarily, and maybe just parts of it, right? Because you still need a lot of your brain, but if you can turn off some of those filters, then all of a sudden you've got the ability to perceive more subtle information that normally we can't notice.
Right. So your work, you're hoping will provide some clues that might help us all to make these deeper connections, by maybe there are areas in the brain, that actually, instead of getting them out of the way, act as a conduit, to such experiences, right?
I think I think both might be true, right? Because, so there's one region in particular that everybody is interested in with this work on the back right quadrant, of the brain. And by the way, there does seem to be a big difference between right and left hemisphere patterns that show up with psychics and mediums. So usually we see way more interesting stuff happening on the right side, which makes a lot of sense. Anybody that knows anything about the differences between the left and right hemisphere, that will resonate very, quickly. But, that back right quadrant has to do with boundaries. So a lot of what that part of the brain is doing normally, when it's kind of doing the job it's designed for, is creating an ego boundary. So essentially saying, I'm separate from you, right? I'm my own individual. I live in this little meat suit, and that's who I am. So it's kind of an identity structure that's creating a boundary. And so what we see a lot of times is that these mediums in particular have a way to disrupt the activity in that region. And so essentially what I think they're doing is kind of knocking it offline temporarily so that those ego boundaries become more blurred, so that they can connect with something outside of themselves, whatever that might be, whether it's somebody who's passed or a spirit guide or whatever it might be. We also see that people that have that ability to quiet down that part of the brain tend to be more empathic, which also makes more sense. They also have more spiritually transcendent experiences. right? Because you're kind of getting yourself out of the way, which is what we hear from everybody. So, you know, we do see certain parts of the brain. Again, this kind of ties into that idea that maybe it's interfering with these abilities. And so we have to learn how to quiet it down. But then you do see parts of the brain that actually become more active at times. But I think those are actually, I don't think that part of the brain is creating a psychic experience or a mediumship experience. I think what we're seeing is the byproduct of the brain processing the information that's coming in. So, for example, we'll see a lot of activity in the occipital lobe, which is the very back of the brain, you know, way back here. And essentially, it's a big part of that part of the brain's job is visual processing. And a lot of times, especially during psychic readings, you'll see that part of the brain light up, right? It's actually more active, it's more engaged. So, especially with like gamma brain waves, like really fast brain waves. And so, I don't think that's causing or creating the psychic experience. I think the brain is processing visual information. It's taking the information that's coming in and translating it into something that can be visually understood by the psychic. So, you know, we need the brain. We have to have the brain to understand what we're getting, right? And so I think sometimes that's what we're seeing.
Well, I like the explanation of the brain as a filter, because there's a lot of mediums have pointed out, you know, without that filter, it would be virtually impossible to navigate your physical life. If you're being bombarded by waves and fields of information that we can't possibly, you know, understand, and the brain does a wonderful job of filtering that out. Also, you know, what always fascinated me was, you know, the DMT, you know, which we all have, you know, and for what purpose, you know, I mean, and that's in your brain. So why would a psychoactive substance be embedded in us all? Not only us, but plant life and animal kingdom, you know, that may be the mechanism by which we all connect. Who knows, right?
You know, and they're still trying to figure that out, you know, because there's some speculation that, and I think they're starting to finally get some evidence that DMT is actually secreted in the pineal gland, which, you know, is another one of those areas that a lot of people talk about as being connected to psychic vision and, you know, these abilities, the third eye, you know, the Ajna chakra, you know. And so, you know, maybe there is something to that, right? That the DMT production in the brain is actually partly what allows us to step into these other worlds, whatever those are. Who knows?
You know, and you know, in your book, Becoming Psychic, you talk about all the different brain waves, but you just mentioned, you know, gamma waves, and the way you explained it is it's really a high vibe. What would you call it? High vibration, high activity, or, you know,
It's a
high
fast
frequency.
frequency.
And you suggested, you know, the gamma rays play a big role in expanded states of consciousness and things that we say, like lucid dreaming and meditation, and even these end of life experiences in the dying brain. And you see increased gamma activity in psychics and mediums and healers as a general rule.
Well, so that's an interesting question. It seemed like a straightforward question, right? You know, but
Nothing straightforward,
nothing is straightforward, right? The answer to everything is it depends, you know, but so yes, you do see gamma show up, especially kind of like we just said in the occipital lobe during psychic type readings. That is a pretty common pattern. But what's interesting is, you know, I don't know how many psychics and mediums' brains I've mapped at this point, you know, dozens, right? And what's interesting is that even though there are certain brain regions that show up consistently, right? So the ones we've talked about, the right frontal lobe, there's certain regions that show up a lot over and over and over and over. But what's really interesting is that the way that they change their brain is not consistent. And what I mean by that is you could take one medium and hook them up and measure their brainwave activity, and maybe they increase gamma in certain regions. And you could take another medium who's equally as skilled and monitor their brain, and they actually decrease gamma in those same brain regions, right? And so it's this very peculiar thing that we're seeing that, well, at first I thought it was peculiar. Actually, from a scientific perspective, I thought it was annoying, right? Because from a scientific perspective, you want everything to be the same, right? It's like, oh, yes, gamma does this for everybody, and that's the ticket. But actually, I think this makes more sense because, we're all individuals. And so, sure, it makes sense that certain parts of the brain might be involved in some of these things, whether it's filtering out or processing information. But at the same time, we're all different. And so, why would we all change our brains the exact same way? Like, that actually makes less sense, right? It actually makes more sense that there's a lot of variation in how people get there.
So, what about the question? Some people will say that when you ask them about their psychic ability, they say, "Oh, I'm not psychic at all. I have no psychic ability." And then a lot of them, especially the mediums, will say, "We all have psychic ability, in varying degrees, obviously, but we all have it." So, you have any opinions through the work over the years? Which is it? Are there people
Okay.
that have no psychic ability?
I mean, maybe, but I tend to lean in the same camp as the psychic mediums that say that we all have these abilities. My current way of thinking about it is that, yeah, this is natural. This is something that we're all sort of born with, and then it gets, kind of trained out of us. And some of that, I think, is from our culture. Right? That, as we get older, we learn what's the appropriate way to think, what's the appropriate thing to talk about, that invisible friends aren't real. And so those filters get stronger and more developed. But some of it is actually, I think, also just a brain developmental process as we get older, because young kids who are often very psychic, right? Like young kids, they know stuff, right? And it's not uncommon at all for them to talk to relatives who have passed, to have, strange experiences in the house, whatever. That's like pretty common. And then it tends to stop, right? Like whatever, age 7, 8, something like that. And you hear this over and over from people. It's like, oh, I used to have these abilities when I was little, and now I don't. And what's interesting is from a brainwave perspective, young kids, their dominant brainwave is actually theta. And theta is a very receptive, open state, right? So theta is the state we go into in hypnosis. It's the state associated with the subconscious. And that's young kids, that's their natural brainwave state. And as we get older, what happens is the brain speeds up and theta becomes sort of secondary, and alpha becomes our dominant brainwave. And one of alpha's jobs is creating a structure, right? So it's that filter. So part of alpha's job is a filtering mechanism. It reduces input. Right. So it's interesting because you can actually see developmentally what is happening in the brain and how that correlates with people sort of quote unquote losing their abilities. So I don't think they're lost. I think they're just, kind of hiding. Right.
Well, so you could start measuring the brainwaves and say, no, you're wrong. You definitely have intuitive ability here. Well, I think about that often because I was always in the camp. I would say I have no psychic ability or intuitive ability, and I base that upon my affinity for gambling, and I try to use it, and I'm terrible. But at the same time, when I'm in various stages of sleep, very often discarnates people on the other side have come to me, and I'll have, and that could be through, the dream visitation or, some vision as if I'm talking to that person. And sometimes it's people that I never met, but in the dream I know who they are, and then I could validate it by, afterwards. So my only conclusion was that I'm useless when I'm awake, but I'm somewhat valuable when I'm unconscious, so, which may make sense to you,
Well,
but.
I mean, it's interesting, right? Because that's pretty common. That's a pretty common experience that people have. These interesting kind of things happen when they're asleep. And then, of course, the trick is, can you hold on to it long enough to remember it when you wake up? And what's interesting is, when you're asleep, what are your dominant brain waves? Right? It's like delta and theta, right? These very slow, deep brainwave states, which is also why you can't stay conscious. If you have a lot of really slow brain waves, you can't stay alert. You can't stay conscious. But it also makes it easier to be open, right, when you're in that state. And so that's actually one of the things that we're interested in kind of working with people on is learning how to essentially shift into a meditative state that allows you to get down there, right? But don't go unconscious. Can you dip into that space and then kind of pop back up, right? So
It's
that you can
that's the
actually kind
trick.
of hold on to it.
With obviously, as you said, you've mapped a large number of mediums, brains, and a lot of them, affiliated with Forever Family Foundation. You've also done a lot of work of late with autistic children. Have you noticed any observable consistencies between those who children who are autistic and have psychic ability and like seasoned mediums or meditators?
I've been working with the telepathy tapes and, some of these nonverbal, autistic individuals who are extremely telepathic. I mean, ridiculously telepathic. I mean, they actually have a lot of other psychic abilities too that, we're still figuring out, including remote viewing and precognition and, healing and all kinds of things, that they're capable of. I've had the ability at this point to map four of their brains when they were engaged in various activities. Two of the data sets are questionable. It's hard to get good EEG when somebody doesn't have good motor control, right? Which is part of the deal with a lot of these kids. They have, apraxic bodies, right? So their mind body connection isn't great, and so they have difficulty controlling their motor movements, and that interferes with getting a good EEG signal, right? But I have been able to get a couple of good recordings, and there are some patterns in there that are at least similar to what we see with psychics and mediums who are neurotypical. Including that sort of right hemisphere, left hemisphere distinction. That's shown up very clearly in some of the recordings that we've done. We've also seen some of those weird changes in the God spot, that right parietal area, as well as the right frontal lobe, another area that shows up a lot. So there have been some consistent patterns. I wouldn't say they're exactly the same, but again, everybody's a little bit different, but there's enough similarities that it does start to suggest that, that maybe these regions of the brain are kind of keys, regardless of, kind of what other kinds of concerns you might be dealing with.
Tell us a little bit more about that, what's termed the God spot. I mean, why that terminology, and where is it?
So that's the spot we were talking about earlier, that right parietal lobe, back here in the back quadrant. And, a lot of scientists would not like that term, the God spot, right? Because, of the implications. However, the media dubbed it that, and it kind of stuck a little bit. And I kind of like it, actually. And where it came from was some research that was done years ago, actually by an ex-colleague of mine at the University of Missouri, where he was looking at people with traumatic brain injuries. And he was looking at people that had injuries in that particular area of the brain. And what he found was that after the injury, they became much more empathic, kind of like we talked about, and reported having more spiritually transcendent experiences, seeing things, feeling things, communicating. And, so then the media got a hold of this and called it the God spot. And so it's kind of stuck a little bit, and partly that's my fault because I keep using it. But I think there's something to it, right? Because I think if we need to, if we have to get out of our own way, if we want to connect to something bigger than ourselves, well, we somehow we have to quiet down those boundaries. Because if you're busy just being an individual, well, there's no way you're going to be able to connect to something else. We have to be able to expand outward in some way. And I think that part of the brain is one of the keys.
So I mean, the God spot is just a term that's used to describe a greater awareness, a connection, something that's beyond the physical. You do a lot of work that you hope will help people that are searching for ways to communicate with their deceased loved ones, but also helping their overall wellness and physical and spiritual well-being. And some of the ways that you do that is through audio-visual entrainment and neurofeedback, which are two of your specialties. So let's get into that a little bit. Audio-visual entrainment. Let's start with that.
What the heck is that?
Yeah.
So when we're talking about audio visual entrainment, we're talking about light and sound stimulation. That's kind of the old school term for that is light and sound stimulation. And basically, the systems that we primarily use essentially involve a pair of specialized glasses that you wear. And the glasses have lights built into the eye sets. And so there's kind of like four lights in like a square shape in each eye set. And then you put headphones on, right? And there's tones in the headphones. And so essentially what happens is, depending on what kind of brainwave state you're wanting to induce, you can pick a program. And let's just, for an example, let's say you're wanting to get into a theta state. And theta brainwaves exist between 4 and 8 hertz. So there's between 4 and 8 cycles per second, which is what defines theta. Well, if you flicker lights in the eyes, say 6 times a second, right? So the lights are going on and off 6 times a second. And there's tones in the ears 6 times a second. Do, 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 do. What happens is that your brain starts to match that pattern. So it's called the frequency following effect, right? So your brain will start to produce more 6 cycle per second activity, which is theta. It's right in the middle of the theta range. So you're essentially using the light and sound, audio visual, to entrain the brain towards specific frequencies. And so what we've been doing with that is using it in some of our psychic exploration classes to introduce people to different frequencies and say, okay, try this one. Does this seem to do anything for you? Does it help you connect in any sort of different way? And so we'll try theta, see what happens. And we'll try gamma, right? The two obvious ones. And then we'll do some, more tricky things, like you could actually split the frequencies so that you're sending one frequency to the left hemisphere and a different frequency to the right hemisphere. So we can try to quiet down the left hemisphere so you're not talking to yourself and making up stories. And then activate the right hemisphere, which is the more intuitive, aware side. So we can do that as well, right? So there's different protocols that we use. And the idea, because everybody's different, right? So we can't just do one protocol and say, this will work for everybody.
Right.
So what we have to do is explore a variety of protocols. And, everybody works with it, each week, whatever the new protocol is. And then we circle back and we talk about it. And then we introduce a new one. And so what we hope happens and what usually happens is that by the end of the class, people have found at least one, sometimes more, protocols that seem to work, right? Seems to kind of nudge them in the right direction. But everybody's different. So half the class may love theta and half the class hates theta.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, nobody hates theta, but
Yeah. I have a t-shirt. I hate theta. But how do you measure the effectiveness? I mean, how does one determine what's working and what's not?
Well, because these classes are on Zoom, we're not really able to like hook everybody's brains up, right? And
Yeah.
see what's going on. So really what we're going by is subjective experience, right? Like, so most of the people in the class have started to explore their own psychic or, spirit communication abilities. And so it's more like, does this seem like it's opening something up for you? And what's interesting is I'd say usually it doesn't seem to have as big of an effect while you're wearing the glasses, but it's like afterwards, right? It's like using it consistently. And this is very common. People will say, oh my God, like the synchronicities are crazy. Like I'm having synchronicities all day long and my dreams are getting super wild, right? And I'm having all these interesting dream experiences. And so what I think we're doing in some cases is we're creating more flexibility in the brain. And so then that starts to show up when you're not wearing the glasses, right? That flexibility of your internal states and being able to, your brain learning how to move in and out of different places starts to carry over into the rest of your life. And so, that's where we feel like there's a success, right? If somebody comes in, they're like, oh, dude, I just had this great reading. That
Yeah.
I, something's happened that's never happened before.
Right.
And it's like, okay, correlation is not causation. And, you get enough of these reports and it starts to feel like, yeah, there's something to this, right? Like we can use this to kind of help nudge people into more flexible states.
So we hear that. I mean, this all the time that what's the correct term? Plasticity of the brain. I mean, the ability to, it can do amazing things. We can change our brains basically, and that's what you're doing. So I guess as your research continues, you may find, and you have more and more data, you'll find specific applications and kind of hone in on that kind of stuff. So, but it's interesting that people that have some mediumistic abilities and want to improve are coming to you for using that protocol.
Yeah, it's actually we've had we just finished up another class and I think that was our 13th class, like series of classes. So we're kind of getting it dialed in. We've kind of got that one figured out pretty well. We recently just started using neurofeedback as a different approach, which does allow us to dial in a little bit more specifically, because neurofeedback for anybody that's not familiar. Measuring your brain waves in real time and getting some sort of immediate feedback about what your brain waves are doing. And so, this allows us to be a little bit more specific. So, depending on where we put the electrode, right? Because we could put an electrode on the God spot and say, okay, well, can you quiet down the God spot? Let's see what happens, right? And so you're having to learn how to do that because you're getting feedback, but the equipment's not doing it for you, right? You still got to learn how to shift it, but you're getting information about like, oh, am I doing something? Is something happening?
Yeah.
Or am I just sitting here,
Right.
right? And so we're just at the beginning of kind of figuring that out. And I think we're getting there, but it may take a minute before we get totally dialed in.
Yeah, well, science has a tendency to be slow sometimes. Yeah.
Yep, moving a barge.
Oh, I mean, some of the stuff is so fascinating. I remember there's a passage in Becoming Psychic book, where you were doing an EEG analysis on somebody that was holding a crystal, you know. I mean, you had a control where they were doing nothing or just having a mundane conversation. In other words, pick up a crystal and you were monitoring it. And the suggestion was that there are some crystals that seem to be aligned with psychic activity, right?
And that starts to get a little far out even for me, right?
Yeah.
And that's why I like looking at brain data, because even though I can't explain how that might work, clearly this person had a more dramatic shift in their brain activity when they were holding the one particular crystal, and that was also the experience where they reported having a more intense connection, right, to whatever they were connecting to.
Yeah.
And so, it's like when those things start to line up, it's like, well, that makes it hard to argue with, right? The subjective experience says one thing, and then the objective data supports that. So something's going on,
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, I know. It's sometimes you must sit there as you're trying all these new things because I know you like to explore and you're blowing your own mind, you know. Just sometimes I say, well, just doing this for shits and giggles, you know. But there's real science behind it, you know. But listen, I know that I mentioned in your introduction that you've worked with several, you know, doctors and doing psychedelic assisted therapies using, you know, ketamine. And you know, now these kinds of therapies are becoming more mainstream, you know, than they were in the past. And it's been proven to have all sorts of positive, you know, effects, not only in grief, but in health and depression and things of that nature. But and I know that because you have your professional life and you also have your personal exploration and growth, and it's always good practice for a scientist to fully understand what their subjects are going through, that you know you tried it, you know, and you had you experimented with ketamine a few times, and I think you described it as a journey where you forgot you had a body, and it was you were just moving through flowing experiences. So, anything else you could tell us about that? Or you weren't monitoring your own brainwaves during this, were you?
I wasn't, no. And that first experience with ketamine in particular was really powerful because it comes on really fast, right? And at least there's different routes of administration. And so the route of administration that we were using at that time was IM, intramuscular, and it's very fast. And it's totally, it was for me, it was very wild because it was like I was a floating consciousness, right? Like, I mean, I could still think and I could still sort of interact with my internal world and whatever I was experiencing, but had no concept of a body. Had I actually for a while I had no concept of who I was, which was weird because I could think, but I didn't know that I was Jeff. I didn't know that I was a psychologist. I didn't know I did this work. I didn't know I was married and had a kids or like, but somehow I still had a consciousness. And so, to me, that was it was very profound, right? Because it feels like it's almost like one of these kind of near-death experience, out-of-body experience kind of things, right? Just induced with medicine, rather than through some sort of trauma or accident or something. But it was very profound because when you come back from that, it was like, oh, whoa, okay, what does this mean? Right? What does this mean? It's one thing to read about it, but then when you experience it, it's like, whoa, okay, there's a whole lot more out there than, my poor little brain knows what to do with,
And then in a sense, I mean, there is a similarity to some of these other experiences because you entered a world of thought, you know. I mean, the material didn't mean anything, you know. You didn't, in your case, you didn't. Like your Jeff memories didn't even travel with you. You were just pure in the moment. Okay, here I am, here I am, here I am. But yeah, so it's as close to being out of body as you can be, right?
And and that's probably the most profound experience like that. I mean, I've worked with a lot of different psychedelic medicines over the years, but I would say from that perspective, this was clearly the most profound because having no concept of your physical nature is pretty dramatic, and it's weird coming back because when you come back, it's almost kind of, and I know you've heard this before, right? But it's from other people who have had similar di but different experiences. Like you almost don't want to come back, right? When you come back, and you're like, oh no, it's like I don't want to be back in this body. Like that was awesome, it's
I
so.
know that I know most of the people report positive experiences, you know, from this. I would imagine there are some people that react negatively because of a variety of reasons, their own fears and phobias and that kind of stuff. I know in my case, I hate to be put in a position where I feel like I'm losing control, and I kind of push back on that, you know. So I worry about that's the only thing that's kept me back from, you know, from doing that stuff. That and some experiences when I was in college, but you know, but what do you on the whole, would you say that most of the experiences are consistently good and constructive and helpful?
I mean, there's certainly, every once in a while there's somebody that has a challenging experience, because of the context in which I'm working with this, right? Which is it's a clinical context. And so, we're meeting with people in advance. We're doing a lot of preparation. They're being screened heavily. They're in a very safe environment. I'm sitting with them the entire time. So, there's a lot of things in place to make, so that even if difficult things come up, it's like that's kind of part of the power of those medicines, right? Is that difficult things might come up, but you gain a different perspective and you gain some insight that you couldn't have otherwise. So, in this context, it's actually very unusual for somebody to have what I'd say as a bad experience. You could have a difficult experience, but usually there's a positive outcome. It's worth it, right? Like, you'll hear people say, like, on like a psilocybin journey, right? I've heard this a lot. People say, like, that was like, 5 years of therapy in like one night, and it's like, yeah. So anybody that's been in therapy, like that sounds horrible, right? It's like 5 years of therapy one night. It's like Jesus. But yet, the outcome is really powerful, right? And it's worth it,
Have any of the subjects reported contact with discarnate entities while they were out of their body?
It was interesting. There was one guy that I was working with, and for various things that he was working on, and we had multiple sessions, so we were pretty comfortable with each other and with the process and whatever. And he came in one particular for a session and told me that his uncle had just passed away, like days, like a couple of days before. And this was somebody that was like a father figure to him. He was very close to. It was unexpected, And of course, my first response was, aside from being, appropriately empathic, right, I was like, I don't know if today's a good day to do this session, right? Like, let's, like maybe we hold off. And he was like, no, I really want to do it. And I was like, oh, all right. And he actually made contact with his uncle in the session and had this really healing experience of kind of talking to his uncle and being able to say goodbye and all these things. And it was like, okay, like I was not expecting that. I didn't set the expectation for that at all. And so it was very surprising, but ended up being very healing for him.
I could imagine. The you talk a lot in your book Becoming Psychic about meditation and the mental states that one is in. I mean, I wrote them down. You talk about focusing, connecting, relaxing, listening, and trusting. I was interested in the relaxing component because it goes back to some of the things we were talking about, reducing the mental activity, and most of the, psychics and mediums that I've encountered over the years, they say, look, you can't, and even the scientists, you can't make things happen in with psychic phenomena. You sort of like have the thought, throw it out into the universe, let it percolate, and whatever's going to happen is going to happen. But then, I could see even with the experience with mediums and sitters, they're like sitting there and they're going, you got to come through, you got to come through, you got to come through, like trying to force that. But, well, you got to come to me in a dream. And, and they're, instead of just setting their intention and letting it go, they're trying to force it. But I think that's true what you found in psychic phenomena. It doesn't work that way, right?
It's such a tricky deal, right? Because it sure seems like and this is where I think the tie-in with meditation is sort of non-efforting. I always joke that it feels like a Taoist riddle, right? It's like try but don't try, right? And it's like, okay, like what does that mean, right? It's like, but I think it's kind of what you're saying, like you can put the intention out there. Clearly, you have an intention. And so that's the trying part. But that's kind of like we have to let it go. And it's really difficult to do. The brain doesn't like to do that. Most of us are control freaks. We want to know what we're doing and how to do it and how to get there. And yeah, this doesn't seem to work that way. And it seems to be true kind of across the board. With different psi abilities, whether it's psychic stuff or mediumship stuff or things like psychokinesis or I've done a little bit of research with that, right? Where you're trying to influence things with your mental thoughts. And if you try too hard, it doesn't work, right? It's like you almost have to almost not care, right? It's like you care, but you don't care. And then it happens easily. It's just like, it's like
I
almost like you're
know.
not paying attention, and then it happens.
Well, I try to I still try to do that when I'm playing poker. When playing poker in certain games, the turning over, sometimes the first three cards and then one card, and there's a card that you want. So instead of saying, let's say I want the king of clubs, I don't go king of clubs, king of clubs. I make like you were saying, like, okay, I want it, but I really don't want it, and I just, try to not think about it. And when I do that, I have better success of the card coming up than if I'm just concentrating like king of clubs, king of clubs. So I try to put that to practical use, So,
Well, and this is and back to the meditation thing, I think it's the same principle in meditation, right? Because and people want to get to a quiet mind state. It's kind of the term we use, right? Where and you talk to most people about that and they're like, oh, I can't get my mind to be quiet. My mind's never quiet. My brain's running around like a crazy monkey, and it's like, okay. And it's weird because if you try too hard to quiet your mind, it doesn't work. Like you can't make your mind be quiet, right? It's like you have
Right.
to sort of like learn how to relax into a place where the mind naturally becomes quiet.
Yeah. Well, it's like with
It's
the same thing. You tell somebody don't do something, they're gonna do it. You know, it's like like when mediums go through the medium certification program, and I'm giving them the protocols at the beginning, and I said, look, I know it's you're put in a position that you're never in before. It's a clinical atmosphere. You're being evaluated. You know, don't be nervous. And they're like, what? You do realize if you say to me, don't be nervous, that's making me more nervous. You know, stop
Right.
saying that. You know, it's like same thing with meditation. You know, but it's interesting. By trying to make quiet your mind, you're making it harder on yourself, right?
Yeah, it's like you're creating tension, right? You know, by setting it up, which is one of the reasons that I like combining meditation with the EEG technology, because it is so good at showing you the smallest amounts of effort. You know, because that's the other thing, like people don't even know they're over-efforting, right? It's like no, I'm not trying too hard. And it's like if I'm looking at the brainwaves, I can tell you. I'm like, dude, you're trying too hard, right? And it's like, no, I'm not. And it's like, yeah, you are. And it's like, you know, you're not even aware of how much you're trying, you know. And so then when you can actually monitor that, it's very insightful.
Yeah. Well, and that's why a lot of the meditation teachers say, it's okay when thoughts come in, just accept it, and then let it go. You know, it's like just
Right. Yeah.
sounds so easy,
Right.
but
Yeah. I mean, yeah, come on. What's so hard, right? You know,
yeah, I know.
it's no big deal.
Yeah. So what are some of these I'm always seeing things advertised. I mean, all the new technologies that are coming out, to help entrain, your brain and to, quiet your mind or induce, altered states. Or I mean, anything that you obviously you work with a lot of stuff, but are there any products that people you've found useful for people to help them and that you could come offhand?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much stuff out there, right? And so it almost depends a little bit on what the particular interest is, right? You know, like so for example, you know, one of the things that has been getting a lot of attention recently is the vagus nerve, right? In relation to kind of a state of relaxation. And you know, there's a lot of new technologies coming out that can stimulate the vagus nerve, you know, kind of directly, indirectly. And so it's amazing, you know, so people who have a lot of anxiety, a lot of tension, you know, using this tech can kind of drop you into that parasympathetic space like almost instantly for some people. And so, you know, so I'm excited about a lot of those. I think there's a lot of potential there because so many of us are running around with chronic stress. You know, and if you're chronically stressed, you can't learn, you know, and you can't expand.
I'd be interested. Incidentally, I don't know about you, but on Facebook and all these things, I'm flooded with ads for vagus nerve things. That's like the hot thing now. But in my own history, I've had some episodes, and they've always termed it a vasovagal episode. So I'm interested in ways to stimulate that. So I think I have to send you an email and ask you for some of these. I'll try
Okay.
them out. I'll be a guinea pig. You know.
Yeah, perfect. Well, I mean, the good thing with a lot of the vagus nerve devices out there is that, you know, many of them are not super expensive and they're pretty easy to use. And I'm always looking for tech like that for things that, you know, that people can access that aren't way out of range. You know, because
Right.
some of the stuff is just ridiculous. You know, like some
Yeah.
of the clinical things are just, you know, it's crazy how much they cost. But then when there's a tool that's, you know, only a few $100, I mean, that's still expensive, you know, I get it. But,
Right.
you know, for something you can use every day that's effective, it's
Yeah.
like, hey, you know, that's
Yeah. Well, I have to consult with you on that.
okay.
All right. We have been talking with Dr. Jeff Tarrant. So all the stuff we're talking about, you could find out a lot more. And as he mentioned, he does his classes and workshops. So if you're looking to kind of shift the your brain waves a bit and enhance your abilities, it might be something to consider. The website is Dr. Jeff Tarrant, and it's Dr. Jeff, Jeff Tarrant, Tarrant dot me. And then the other professional website is neuromeditationinstitute.com. The book is Becoming Psychic, Lessons from the Minds of Mediums, Healers, and Psychics. And that you could find it, Amazon or wherever you buy your books. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Look forward to talking with you again soon, and we'll keep in touch. You could also listen to Jeff on the telepathy tapes because he's a big part of that. All right, Jeff, have a good
Cool.
evening. Good
Thanks,
evening,
Bob.
everybody out there. Have a good night. Bye
Bye,
now.
everybody.